Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the City Briefing webcast. At this time, all audio participants are in a listen-only mode, and during the presentation, we'll have a question and answer session, and at that time, if you wish to ask a question, you'll need to press star and one on your telephone keypad. Alternatively, you can submit questions at any time via the webcast, and these will be answered at the end. I must advise you that the webcast is being recorded today, Wednesday the 13th of December 2017. And I'd now like to hand to your presenter today, to David Black. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Jenny, and good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Ofwat City Investor Call. So the water sector has been more in the public eye in 2017 than might normally be the case. In many ways, that's a good thing. It's shone a light on a sector that's fundamental to everyone in the UK and isn't normally seen as newsworthy. We have seen positive news stories about how companies are removing fatbergs from sewers and using drones to detect leaks. But we've also seen less positive stories focusing on how companies are financed and run. And these news stories matter because customers in England and Wales feel differently about water to many other services. Customers expect great service, at least comparable with the service they get elsewhere. They expect water and wastewater services to be resilient to both short-term shocks and long-term challenges, such as population growth and climate change. They expect those services to be affordable for all and there to be help for those struggling to pay. So our 2019 price review enables, incentivizes, and encourages water companies to innovate and find new and better ways of achieving things that matter to customers. Great service, affordable bills, and reliable, resilient services. That's why the four themes for our 2019 price review, great customer service, resilience in the round, affordability and innovation. We see these as directly linked to the delivery of our strategy of trust and confidence in water. On the 11th of July, we published our draft methodology, and we spoke with many of you a day later, where we set out what our draft methodology would do and how it would work. Our methodology builds on the 2014 price review, and the work we've since carried out under the Water 2020 programme to evolve our regulatory framework for 2019 and beyond. We received more than 60 responses to our consultation, twice as many as which we received at the same stage in PR14. We're grateful to those who took the time to respond. We've listened to the responses we've received, changed our approach where we've been convinced that we needed to change, and maintained our approach where we weren't. I'm now going to step through the key elements of the review and flag the changes since our methodology before going to our Q&A session. Firstly, on the initial assessment of business plans. Our overall approach to assessing company plans remains the same as we proposed in July. It's all about incentivising companies to deliver plans with more of what matters to their customers. That means business plans should be right first time without requiring Ofwat to step in and force companies to be efficient or set themselves more stretching performance equipment. We'll be assessing companies' business plans on their quality, ambition and innovation. And we'll categorise companies into four categories: exceptional, fast track, slow track, and significant scrutiny. Exceptional plans are plans which are high quality, ambitious, and innovative. These are plans that really shift the cost and performance frontier to benefit customers. To reflect the effort that companies with exceptional plans put in and the risks they will take, they will receive a one-off amount equivalent to 20 to 35 basis points additional on their return on regulated equity over the whole price review period. We will decide on the point in the 20 to 35 point range based on the level of ambition and innovation shown in the plan. In our July consultation, we proposed 20 basis points, so this range is an increase from our methodology consultation. Companies with exceptional plans will receive an early draft determination with reputational benefits, and this draft determination will include, if companies elect to take this option, early certainty on cost adjustment claims, bespoke performance equipment, outperformance and underperformance payment rates for outcome delivery incentives. Fast track plans are plans which are really high quality, where we consider that they require no or minor or limited interventions in the customer interests, but they're not plans that are frontier shifting in their ambition and innovation. Here we've also modified our approach to incentivize fast track plans, and they will receive early draft determinations, including optional early certainty and reputational benefits, but they will also receive a one-off amount equivalent to 10 basis points addition on the return on regulated equity over the price review period. Slow track plans are plans that require a level of material intervention by Ofwat to protect customers, such as the failure to manage or mitigate risks to resilience, inefficient levels of costs, or insufficiently stretching performance commitments, or over-generous incentives. Companies with slow track plans may be required to submit parts of their business plan or to provide additional evidence. Again, they are likely to find the 2019 review challenging, or be required to deliver on stretching cost and performance commitments, and because they are less likely to be efficient or have weaker performance, they are likely to start the new period behind on these targets. So unless they take up the challenge on cost and performance, they'll be more exposed to outcome delivery incentive penalties and reduced cost sharing rates. Significant scrutiny plans are plans that fall well short of our expectations and raise serious concerns as to whether the evidence and data provided by companies provide a satisfactory basis for the final determination. Now, there's no reason why any company should end up in this category, and the consequences of poor quality plans are serious. It'll be difficult to rely on company information, so as to protect customers, we'll be setting tough cost-sharing rates and ensure there's little benefit to companies from providing poor business plan information. Our performance payments could be capped on bespoke and potentially common performance outcomes too. We also think there'll be a reputational impact of being identified as having an inadequate business plan and potentially increase future assurance requirements. Moving on to outcomes. Outcomes are the high-level objectives that matter most to customers. We're keeping with the approach that we outlined in our consultation. We're expecting companies to engage extensively with their customers on setting their outcomes with assurance on the engagement process provided by the independent customer challenge groups. We'll be encouraging companies to propose stretching performance commitments, supported by long-term projections to at least 2035 of their expected performance levels, so that customers can benefit from improved service quality and companies focus on the longer term. We'd expect companies to set stretching bespoke performance commitments based on customer priorities, and we'll be requiring all companies to have 14 common performance commitments and to set stretching levels for them. Following consultation responses, we have modified our approach to performance commitments so that we challenge companies to achieve the forecast upper quartile level of performance for each year of the price review period, rather than applying the 2024-25 upper quartile commitments from 2021 onwards as set out in our price review methodology consultation. For supply interruptions, internal sewer flooding and pollution incidents, we expect companies to propose performance commitments that are at least the forecast upper quartile performance for each year, and we'll also challenge companies to reduce leakage by 15% by 2025. And I think it's great to see some companies have already taken up this challenge. As we set out in our consultation, we'll be bringing ODI performance payments and underperformance penalties closer in time to the performance they relate to. This will better align the interests of company management, investors with customers. We expect companies' ODI proposals will drive an expected outcome delivery incentive out and underperformance range of plus or minus 1 to 3%. Of return on regulated equity, and this will not be capped to these levels. This range includes the enhanced outperformance and performance payments for frontier shifting performance on the common performance commitments as set out in the graphic. We expect companies to propose approaches to protecting customers in case their ODI payments turn out to be above or outside their expected RORI range for ODIs. On balance, a company that delivers levels of performance consistent with our benchmarks from 2020 to 2025 would neither receive outperformance payments nor underperformance penalties in net terms on their ODIs. We're also introducing our new customer measure of experience and developer service measure of experience, referred to as CMEX and DMEX respectively. These will incentivise companies to improve their customer service, which still lags behind other sectors. CMEX includes customer satisfaction for customers who have not contacted their water company, as well as those that do, and will have a comparison with upper quartile performance in other sectors. We've modified our approach to CMEX and its methodology consultation so that access to enhanced financial payments is conditional on companies having a satisfactory performance in regard to complaints. For the DMEX, we're also following consultation, taking account of consultation responses. We will include an element based on service performance metrics as well as customer satisfaction. Cost efficiency. We expect a step change in cost efficiency for the sector. Customers depend on water companies to take action to drive efficiency in their businesses, and companies should challenge their own plans to make sure they don't contain any inefficiency. The TOTEX approach and outcomes which we introduced at PR14 and we continue with in PR19 give companies the flexibility to decide on how best to deliver their services and to use the most cost-effective and innovative approaches. TOTEX and outcomes have resulted in significant efficiency gains in other sectors, and there's early evidence in this period of efficiency gains in the water sector too. As we set out in our July consultation, we will not use a menu approach as an incentive to submit accurate cost forecasts. Instead, we'll use a mechanism based on cost sharing as an incentive for companies to submit efficient cost forecasts. The mechanism works such that efficient plans will get more favourable cost sharing rates than inefficient plans, and they'll be able to keep a higher proportion of savings and bear a lower proportion of cost overruns that are delivered in period. We've adjusted our proposed cost-sharing rates since the methodology consultation to provide a stronger incentive for companies to submit efficient plans and to ensure the schemes better protect customers against inefficient business plans and against any perceived risks around gaming. The new cost-sharing scheme is shown in the slide. When a company submits its business plan, its TOTEX ratio will be determined by the ratio of its forecast to our view of efficient TOTEX. This in turn will deliver its cost sharing rates. Each company will have one sharing rate for outperformance and another rate for underperformance. The cost sharing mechanism will apply for the total revenue controls only, water resources, water network plus, and wastewater network plus. In addition, for significant scrutiny plans, we will set these companies a cost-sharing rate of 75% for underperformance and 25% for outperformance. This means that significant scrutiny companies will only keep 25% of any cost outperformance, but bear 75% of cost underperformance, reflecting our lack of confidence in their business plan. To set efficient cost baselines, we will use comparative assessment to form a view of efficiency. For the majority of companies' costs, this will mean econometric models for cost benchmarking, plus a separate assessment of some other costs, such as some components of enhancement expenditure and business rates. Our efficient cost baseline will be informed not only by assessment of the sector, but also of information from other sectors and the wider economy. We will allow companies to make well-evidenced representations in support of adjustments to our cost baselines, but we will have a high evidential bar for accepting any cost adjustment claims. And we also will make the adjustment process symmetrical. Any adjustments that we will make, we will consider where appropriate to decrease cost allowances and to offset the increases elsewhere. We see significant scope for greater markets for resources, bioresources, eco-services, and direct procurement of large efficiency projects to improve efficiency and the resilience of services. Moving on to the cost of capital. So the cost of capital is a key variable in this price review. If we set it too high, bills may be seen as higher than customers need to pay. Company profits may be seen as excessive. and the legitimacy of the sector may be called into question. Set it too low and companies' ability to raise the finance they need to carry out their functions may be put at risk, with the resulting impact on services to customers. We said in July that we would set out our initial view of the cost of capital alongside the December methodology, and that we're expecting it to start with a 2. And as you will have seen, our initial view of the cost of capital on an RPI real basis is 2.4%, which compares with 3.7% in the 2014 review. Our view of the cost of capital is underpinned by a real RPI-based cost of equity of 4.0% and a cost of debt of 1.3%, with gearing at 60%. Of course, as we're transitioning to CPIH as a means of indexing price controls and the RCV, we are also setting a CPIH-based cost of capital, which is around 3.4%. Which is 3.4%. And all things being equal, this amounts to around about £15 to £25 off customer bills. Our view of the cost of capital is underpinned by a long-term view of RPI of 3% and of CPIH at 2%. This is higher than the RPI assumption that underpinned the 2014 cost of capital and higher than the range we used when we set our view around the range of cost of equity in July, both of which were 2.8%. So you need to see the WACC allowance in those contexts. Our initial view of the cost of capital at 2.4% in RPI terms is consistent with the range of expectations we have seen published by market commentators, city analysts and rating agencies. And it's based on evidence that show that both the cost of equity and debt are lower than they were in 2014. In the past, regulators have tended to take both historical returns and forward-looking returns into account, with more weight being placed on historical returns, historical market returns. As we set out in our July consultation, we consider there's good reason to expect that the required returns will be lower for the period to 2025. We commissioned further work from PwC and a new report from Europe Economics on the cost of capital. Both reports confirm that an overdependence on long-run historical returns are likely to overstate the expected total market returns for 2020-2025. We have chosen a point estimate at the upper end of the PwC range, which reflects forward-looking evidence of expected returns, as well as academic literature and market evidence. Our approach to the cost of debt follows extensive consultation. As we set out in our July consultation, we'll take separate approaches for embedded and new debt. We will set a fixed allowance for embedded debt, drawing on both benchmark data and debt instruments issued by companies. The evidence shows that companies in the sector outperform market benchmark data, so our early view is based on the median cost of debt for the sector. We recognise that the actual cost of embedded debt varies between companies, and as a result, there may be under or outperformance compared to our allowance, depending on their own financing arrangements. Consistent with our long-held view, it's investors that should bear this risk, not customers. We will index the cost of new debt by reference to iBoxx indices for non-financial companies with a tenor of 10 or more years, with an end-of-period reconciliation adjustment to account for any differences. We'll apply a downward adjustment of 15 basis points to the index to reflect evidence that companies typically outperform the market benchmark. In addition, we will allow an upward adjustment of 10 basis points for issuance and liquidity costs, and we'll make an inflation adjustment as part of the end-of-period reconciliation consistent with our long-term CPIH assumption of 2%. We consider that this approach best satisfies all of our duties and protects customers by removing the risk of forecast error, but also protects companies where there is an unanticipated increase in the market cost of debt. We'll only consider company-specific adjustments to the cost of debt where there is evidence that the cost is reasonable and that the benefits to customers from allowing that there is benefits to the customers from allowing such an uplift and customer support. Efficient companies should be able to raise finance on reasonable terms. Each company will be required to submit a financeable business plan, with board assurance that its plan is financeable on both a notional and actual capital structure. We interpret our financing functions duty as at the activities of the appointee, so we will assess financeability at their pointy level by reference to the national capital structure that underpins our view of cost of capital. We note that companies have a number of options to address financeability constraints that arises under a national financial structure, and we'll be looking for evidence of customer support where companies have taken steps to address such constraints. And to reiterate, the choice of the actual capital structure and financing is a matter for companies and their shareholders, and companies should not expect customers to bear the cost of addressing any financing constraints resulting from their actual financing structure or inefficient financing strategies. Moving on to the overall balance of risk and return. In response to consultation, some companies and investors raised concern that the risk and return package was somehow asymmetrically skewed to the negative. As a result, we've explained that we've revisited the risk and return package with revised financial incentives for the initial assessment of business plans and TOTEX cost sharing, and clarified that performance commitment benchmarks for companies to target upper quartile in each year. There will be scope for outperformance where companies deliver on things that matter to customers. The overall impact on risk and return from our incentives can be seen in the effect on the return on regulated equity in the slide. Should be noted that for our delivery incentives, we've used the stylized illustrative or example of plus or minus 2%, the midpoint of the indicative range, as we think it's unlikely that a company will outperform an upper quartile performance across all the ODIs for the full duration of price control and so achieve the 3%. TOTEX outcome performance is based on a 10% under overspend against price controls for each of the price controls based on historical evidence. For the Network Plus and Water Resource Controls, the cost of outcome performance is shared between companies and customers based on the cost sharing rates, whereas we assume companies bear 100% of the impact for cost of outcome performance on the retail controls and the bioresource controls. The difference in cost sharing rate is the main difference between the return on regulated equity of the companies in scrutiny and those in the other categories. The differences between slow track, fast track and exceptional is due to the additional incentives for fast track and exceptional plans, but we note that fast track and exceptional companies are likely to achieve higher returns on regulated equity through outperformance on TOTEX and ODIs, and this is not reflected in the chart. All of this shows that the potential to earn higher returns for higher performance has increased since PR 14, while the downside for poor performance has increased too, reflecting a sharpening of the incentives in customers' interests. The next step. So it's now over to companies to submit to us by the 3rd of September 2018 high quality, ambitious and innovative business plans that deliver more of what matters for customers. In the meantime, at Ofwat, we're gearing up for the price review proper, and the leadership team of Aileen Armstrong, John Russell and myself is already in place. And on delivery, we expect to appoint our delivery partner for the price review next spring and begin onboarding them shortly after. So in conclusion, at a time of increasing scrutiny and facing long-term challenges, we have developed a methodology which enables and challenges the sector to step up and deliver both now and in the long term. We see significant opportunities in this methodology for companies who are willing to challenge themselves and shift the funding for costs and service. For companies that don't, we'll be stepping in to ensure that customers are protected. So thank you. I'm pleased to say I'm joined by John Russell and Aileen for the question time, so I'll now hand back to the operator to take any questions that you may have on our methodology statement. Thank you.
That's perfect. Thank you very much, sir. So, just a gentle reminder, if you wish to ask a question on the telephone, please press star and one on your telephone keypad and wait for your name to be announced. Alternatively, you can submit questions via the webcast. Now, I think we do have a question on the web and we also have a couple on the phones. Would you like to go to the phones first?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. So from Macquarie, we have a question from the line of Dominic Nash, and your line is open.
Hi, guys. Thank you for that. I've got two questions, please, if I may. So the first one is on, unsurprisingly, cost of capital. You write in this document that this is still sort of an initial view cost of capital, and whilst it is understandable that the cost of debt may well swing between now and 2019. Is the cost of equity now actually fixed out to 2025 in either your real or nominal sort of benchmark, or is that liable to change as we go through the determinations? And then the second question is, you're very open up front saying there's a 15 or potential 15 to 25 pounds reduction in bills. That's been picked up by the press. Is that a signal to the water companies as to where you would like to see bills go? Because ultimately, this is going to be down to their sort of pay-as-you-go mechanism and their financeability and all the other bits and pieces within it. Or are you actually giving them a very powerful signal that that is what you would like to see in the business plan submissions?
Okay, thank you, Dominic. So the first question on the cost of equity, we will be revisiting both the cost of equity and the cost of debt at the time of the draft and final determinations in 2019. I think you're right that some parameters of cost of equity, like total market returns, the evidence is by its nature not that prone to being updated at the time of the inside the 18 months that we have before we set the cost of capital. But there will be, I'm sure, new evidence to take account of, and so we'll look at that. I think in regard to other parameters like the equity betas, there will be extensive new data available. So you'll have seen in the methodology statement that we've used primarily two-year range, historical range on equity betas. So by its nature, there will be quite a lot of new data by the time we get to PR19. So we'll be taking, and also there may be further regulatory decisions from other regulators, and so we'll be looking at those as well. So there are some reasons why the cost of equity might change by PR19 as well as the cost of debt. In terms of customer bills, the £15 to £25 is merely an arithmetic calculation of the impact of the reduction in the cost of debt. It's very much up to the companies to look at the efficiency gains, to look at the benefits from the WACC reduction, to look at other reasons why bills may be going down in PR19, but to engage with the customers on how they best want to use that headroom in terms of things like new investment for resilience, or in terms of assistance for customers struggling to pay, or in terms of indeed bill reductions for all customers. I think the point we would make is that the great thing for PR19 is that there is considerable headroom there. It's not just the WACC reduction, I'd note. We're also expecting a step up in cost efficiency as well. So there is, as you note, quite a different scope, and we look forward to business plans and how companies will make best use of this in their customers' interests.
Is there not a sort of follow-up on that, though? Is there not a risk that you're putting an expectation into the market and the sort of the journalists and the politicians that this is the level of price cut expected, and if it doesn't get delivered, then you're open to some sort of pushback here?
We've been very clear as to what the calculation has been based on, and we're also very clear that the individual circumstances of companies and their customers will need to drive the actual bill changes in any one particular company.
Great, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, sir. Your next telephone question comes from the line of Deepa Venkateswaran, and your line is now open.
Thank you very much. My question has been partially answered, and it is on the WACC. It has been partially answered, but I probably have a follow-up to the question on WACC. Looking at the cost of equity, you said that maybe the beta can get updated, but likely that TMR and risk-free rate or the equity risk premium stays the same. In terms of cost of debt embedded, do you see that change significantly? I guess new debt could change, but that will be indexed. So just wanted your view on the cost of debt. And secondly, in terms of timing, I guess the next update is going to be in April, March of 19, along with the enhanced or the fast-track determinations?
Yes, in terms of the cost of debt, the cost of embedded debt, we will have some new information by PR19. For a start, we'll get company business plans, and that will have updated information on their embedded cost of debt. We've made some assumptions about company refinancing in the period, rest of the period to 2020, so there will be some new information. It may not change the embedded cost of debt, but at least there will be new information. And in terms of when we update, we'll need to decide as part of the PR19 process as to when we make the revised cost of capital, whether we leave it to the final set of draft determinations in July, and then what weight we put on an update for the final determinations. I note in PR14, we focus most of our attention on final determinations. I think it would make sense to do an update for the draft determinations as well as the final, given the time period we've got now. But we'll decide that in 2019.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. And now your next question comes from the line of Lakis Athanasiou, and your line is now open.
Hi there, guys.
Hi, Lakis.
Hi. My question's on credit metrics. Calculating for the notional company who's just meeting your allowed return, not outperforming or underperforming, I get that the Moody's adjusted interest cover is just above 1.4, so just within a Baa1 range. And if they underperform, they're outside of it, below that. Second on the Moody, the S&P FFO to debt, that's at 8%, which is below the 9% threshold for BBB+. Now, for S&P, you can adjust with pay-as-you-go ratio shifts. And I get that you would need a 6% shift on pay-as-you-go versus a natural OPEX split, which adds about 4% to bills to actually meet the 9%. So it seems to me it's one of two things. You're either have embedded for the notional structure of a company who's delivering at your stringent ODI and TOTEX targets, we'll either have to embed in a 6% pay-as-you-go shift or be satisfied with a BBB. And for companies underperforming, you've probably pushed them into a BBB range. So, I mean, do you think that's safe to actually start off with an implicit assumption that you need pay-as-you-go ratio shifts and or a move into a BBB debt range?
Thanks, Lakis. So, you know, we've asked as part of business plans companies to submit to us plans that they can provide board assurance around that of financeable and notional actual structure. We think the evidence that they provide is up to them. We haven't set out any views about target ratios. We have provided, obviously, in the financial model scope to calculate those. We have undertaken modelling of our own based on information that we have before business plans arrive in terms of the impact on ratios from our cost of capital, and we're satisfied that the notional company will be financeable on the basis of the cost of capital that we have set. Until we see the business plans themselves and the information provided in them, it's probably a bit more difficult for me to say much more than that in response to your comments.
Well, you don't need to look at the business plans. Your notional company, for a company delivering the allowed return you're allowing, will end up either in BBB territory or it will have to make pay-as-you-go ratio shifts of 6%. It's one or the other. You know, there are no ifs and buts. There are no maybes. There's no need to look at the business plans. Your notional company will deliver that. So I'm just saying, is that a safe thing to do? We know that from now. We don't need to look at the business plans. You've given us enough information to make those calculations. And you seem to be saying we need to embed in pay-as-you-go shifts or be satisfied with BBB.
We're satisfied that the cost of capital we have set is financeable, and that's all I'm going to say, I think, at this point. I don't think there's any point in terms of saying it's going to mean this pay-go shift or that pay-go shift. In fact, the parameters will depend on a company's business plan. It will depend on their RCV growth. It will depend on their own structures. So we are, you know, we will judge that when companies submit their plans. But I, you know, I'm very confident that on a national company basis, that companies are financed. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Now your next question from HSBC comes from the line of Verity Mitchell, and your line is now open, ma'am.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm just going to also go back to a question on the embedded debt, and two things. Firstly, if you would like to talk through your change in gearing assumptions, which is new, and also why you think it's appropriate to apply a downward adjustment to the debt indices on the basis that you say that companies, I mean all companies, typically outperform the market benchmark. So it sounds like you're picking a market-related benchmark and then applying an additional discount. So those two things would be very helpful. Thank you.
Sure. So in terms of the change in gearing, as part of setting the notional capital structure, we need to set out our view of the gearing for that structure. In our July methodology, we said it wouldn't be any higher than the 62.5% we set in PR 14. We think an appropriate level is 60%. That's a small downward adjustment since PR 14, and that's on the basis of both what we see in terms of the sector. So there is some evidence of reductions in gearing. There's also some evidence of companies moving to shorter-term debt, but also what we see in wider markets about debt. But secondly, in terms of our methodology of putting more focus on markets and potentially increasing the volatility of returns or revenues over time, and therefore we think it's appropriate to make that small downward adjustment in gearing. In terms of the outperformance on debt, in PR 14 we also made a 15 basis point adjustment to both new and embedded debt, and there is, you know, there has been evidence and there is evidence that the sector outperforms. My understanding is that over the last 8 years it's around 55 basis points on debt. So there is evidence that the sector is financing itself cheaper than benchmark. We think it's appropriate that customers should pay the efficient costs. Clearly if there's evidence that companies regularly outperform these indices, then it's appropriate to make an adjustment. In terms of the forward-looking adjustment for new debt, that does require making an assumption, and we've taken into account the fact that interest rates are lower, and therefore you might expect the absolute levels of outperformance to be lower, and that's how we've derived the 15 basis points for the new debt. On the embedded debt, it's very clear that the cost of debt is lower than the market benchmarks, and so therefore we've taken that into account in our analysis.
Okay, thank you. Can I just a quick follow-up, which is why you picked mid-2017 yields in terms of repayment? You didn't take a range of time, given that companies have very different refinancing profiles.
So in terms of deriving the cost of embedded debt?
Yeah.
So I think that's in terms of the most recent available information that we have, and that's why we've used it in terms of setting our cost of capital for our initial view.
Okay, just a spot basis, not any range of, given that most companies don't necessarily.
So we're taking into account the fact that companies are financing on a long-term basis. So the fact that the embedded debt is, is based on long, a rolling average of that debt, and it is looking out at the debt which is 10 to 20 year maturity.
Thanks.
But it is trying to derive what the relevant cost is in today's terms.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, ma'am. Now, your next question from Deutsche Bank comes from the line of Duncan Scott, and your line is now open, sir. Mr. Scott, your line is open, sir. Mr. Scott, are you there? Your line is open.
Oh, hello. Actually, it's James Brown from Deutsche Bank. Sorry, the line isn't that great because I'm travelling today.
I understand.
Actually,
please go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah, sorry. If you can hear me okay, I just had a question on the ODIs. Just to clarify, you're putting in place a number of common ODIs, and the upside and downside range on ODIs is a fairly important part of your differentiation between good performing companies and bad performing companies. But there was also a comment in the document that seemed to suggest that customer challenge groups would have a pretty important role in terms of determining, you know, whether companies would have upside and downside ODIs or just downside ODIs. So I wanted to just clarify whether the common ODIs that you were putting in place, whether you would be prescriptive in terms of the magnitude of the upside and downside. and if not, whether that was reasonable, given that it was such an important part of the ability of allowing good companies to earn good returns, whether you shouldn't be more prescriptive. Thanks.
In terms of outcome performance commitments, we do want companies to engage with their customers on their proposed outcome delivery incentives for each of the outcome performance commitments, and we expect companies to provide evidence around their customer views on their proposed ODI outperformance payments and penalties. The customer challenge groups have a role in terms of providing assurance around the company's engagement with customers rather than on the providing views on the level of rewards themselves. We've set out our guidance in terms of our expectations about what we think a sufficient incentive will be to align companies' interests with their customers. But we do think it's important that any outcome delivery incentives are based around customer views. We've made it clear that we think there's a potential wide range of evidence to draw on in terms of understanding customer preferences and priorities. And we'd expect companies to use that in providing their views to us. And that applies both to the common and to the bespoke outcome performance equipment. So we are expecting our companies to take account of customer views and to base the outcome delivery incentives on the evidence they have around the customer preferences. Because these do feed through ultimately to customer bills, so it's very important that there is customer support for any proposal to provide an outperformance payment for an improvement.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, sir. And now from the Royal Bank of Canada, you have a question from the line of Maurice Choi, and your line is now open, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Two questions from me. The first question is on the cost of equity. And you mentioned that it is subject to change pending market evidence. Given that, I guess the first inclination of any revision will be in March 2019, I just want to know whether if you would also consider if, given that Brexit is happening, it's meant to complete then, or even the threat of nationalization, how does that feed into this view of cost of equity? And then second point is also very related, cost of debt. Given that if we do believe that the Brexit process is going to go through and complete, the removal of EIB, which is obviously one of the cheapest cost of debt to the market right now, will obviously affect the financing performance of every company that has access to that. How do you then justify that a 15 bips discount should be implemented, or even any discount should be implemented? Thank you.
Okay. So in terms of cost of equity, so I think you're right that by the time we get at least the final determinations, we should have some evidence of the impact of Brexit, if there is any, in terms of on both market cost of debt and cost of equity. And we will obviously be able to take that into account. I'm not going to speculate as to what it might be, but obviously markets are able to take account of what we're aware of it at the present point in time. And so we've made our view on the initial cost of capital on the current evidence that's available. In terms of the cost of debt in the EIB, it's true the EIB is an important source of financing, I think for around about 10% of the debt in the sector, but that does mean that 90% of the debt is funded from elsewhere, and it's very clear that the financing advantages that the sector has over indices is not just based on the EIB funding, it is based on a more broader range of outperformance across many different types of debt the sector has. So we do think it's relevant and appropriate to take that into account for PR19. Thank you. Shall we just do one check, operator, on any more calls on the line?
At this point, there are no further telephone questions, sir.
Okay. Yes. Can we take... So we'll take some of the web-based questions. So the first one was around... the embedded cost of debt. Sorry, I can't quite see the question on my screen. But, yes, that was about whether that will be updated at PR19. The answer is yes. I think we've already discussed that. Second question from Ian Turner of Exane BNP Paribas was around philosophically how you can have a negative real risk-free rate. I'm probably not going to answer the philosophical question. I am going to say it's what you observe in the market, and it's what we have observed actually over a number of years now. And just like the price of tomatoes is negative in the market, that's the price of tomatoes. And so if the risk-free rates are negative, then that is the underpinning that we ought to take into account. So we do look at the evidence, and that's the evidence that's in front of us. The third question was in relation to what was the process to appoint Europe Economics, who were one of our advisors around on the cost of capital. So that was, as with all of what procurement process is, an open and contestable process. There were a number of bidders, and Europe Economics was selected. We also had a revised report from PwC, who were advisors at the earlier stage of the draft methodology. So we had advice from two sets of consultants in that regard. So that was the response to that question. Further question from Toby Richardson on question was, how would you expect companies to reconcile differences between the upper quartile performance commitments and feedback from customer engagement? For example, where it is clear that there's a cost to meeting upper quartile performance commitments, but customers don't want to pay. So I think we need to be clear about two distinctions. One is about the stretching level of performance commitment, and so that is based on a range of evidence, including evidence of forward-looking upper quartile performance in the sector, expected performance. So that doesn't require customers to pay more. That's a decision in terms of our cost allowances. The only thing that matters for companies is if they don't deliver that, they'll incur a penalty, and so therefore their customers will pay less. So there isn't any additional cost for customers from ratcheting up performance commitments, rather the reverse. The net cost to customers is lower. But it is important that that's why the outcome delivery incentive, our performance payments and penalties, why it's important that they're calibrated on customer views, because it's that feeds into companies' decisions about how far and how fast they go to pursue these performance commitments. Finally, there's a question about how will you protect customers from higher than expected performance payments, and does your concern have anything to say about 7% sewer flooding performance? And in one ODI, the company seems to have captured 95% of all of its ODI payments. So I think there's two elements that's probably worth discussing. One is around the role of caps on outperformance payments and penalties. So in PR14, we set a cap of 2% on return on regulated equity. We are removing that cap, and we've extended our view on terms of the expected range of performance to plus or minus 1-3%. The reason why we're comfortable in removing the caps is that because, unlike at PR14, we will have much better comparative information around what stretching benchmarks look like. In PR14, performance commitments were new, and there was little data at the time we set the performance commitments, hence the need for a safeguard cap. However, we do think there is an issue about unexpected events impacting upon potential performance payments and penalties, and so we are asking companies to clearly make it clear that they understand their tail distribution risks and to explain how they're going to mitigate risks to customers. I'd also note that individual caps and collars may still be applicable to outcome delivery incentives, particularly where there are large incentives relating to a single performance commitment. But we do think that caps and collars in themselves have the potential to discourage companies from going further when it actually would be very beneficial from a customer perspective in terms of pushing frontier performance, so we think it's right to remove them. Thank you. I think that's all the questions we have on the screen. So if there are no further questions, I was going to propose to close the call, operator.
Of course, thank you very much indeed, sir. And with many thanks to all our speakers today, that does conclude this webcast. Thank you all for participating, and you may now disconnect. Please stay online for me, sir.